Pedro Nile grunted as Morgaze placed a white stone on the board with a smile of triumph. Lesser players might set 2 dozen more stones each yet, but he could see the inevitable course now, and so could she. In the beginning, the golden-haired woman seated on the other side of the small table had played to lose, to make the game close enough to be interesting for him, but it had not taken her long to learn that that led to obliteration. Not to mention that he was clever enough to see through the subterfuge and would not tolerate it. Now she plied all her skill and managed to win nearly half their games. No one had beaten him so often in a good many years. "The game is yours," he told her, and the Queen of Andor nodded. Well, she would be queen again. He would see to that. In green silk, with a high lace collar brushing her chin, she looked every inch a queen despite the sheen of perspiration on her smooth cheeks. She hardly appeared old enough to have a daughter Elaine's age, though, much less a son Gawain's.
"You did not realize I saw the trap you were laying from your 31st stone, Lord Nile, and you took my feint from the 43rd stone to be my real attack."
Excitement sparkled in her blue eyes. Morgaze liked to win. She liked playing to win. It was all meant to lull him, of course, the playing at stones, the politeness. Morgaze knew she was a prisoner in the Fortress of the Light in all but name, albeit a luxuriously pampered prisoner, and a secret one. He had allowed stories of her presence to spread, but issued no proclamations. Andor had too strong a history of opposing the Children of the Light. He would announce nothing until legions moved into Andor, with her their figurehead. Morgaze certainly knew that as well. Very probably she also knew he was aware of her attempts to soften him. The treaty she had signed gave the children rights in Andor they had never possessed anywhere except in Amadicia, and he expected that she already planned how to lighten his hand on her land, how to remove his hand altogether as soon as she could. She had only signed because he backed her into a corner. Yet confined in that corner, she fought on as skillfully as she maneuvered on a stone's board. For one so beautiful, she was a tough woman. No, she was tough, and that was that. She did let herself be caught up in the pure pleasure of the game, but he could not count that a fault when it gave him so many pleasant moments. Had he been even 20 years younger, he might have played more to her true game. Long years as a widower stretched behind him, and the Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light had little time for pleasantries with women, little time for anything except being Lord Captain Commander. Had he been 20 years younger, well, 25, and she not trained by the Tarvalin witches. It was easy to forget that, in her presence. The White Tower was a sink of iniquity and the shadow, and she touched deeply by it. Radam Asunawa, the High Inquisitor, would have tried her for her months in the White Tower and hanged her without delay, had Nile allowed it. He sighed regretfully. Morgaze kept her victorious smile, but those big eyes studied his face with an intelligence she could not hide. He filled her goblet, and his own, with wine from the silver pitcher sitting in a bowl of cool water that had been ice a little while ago.
"My Lord Nile." The hesitation was just right, the slim hand half-stretched across the table toward him, the added respect in how she addressed him.
Once she had called him simply Nile, with more contempt than she would have handed a drunken groom. The hesitation would have been just right, had he not had the measure of her.
"My Lord Nile, surely you can order Galad to Amador so I may see him? Just for a day."
"I regret," he replied smoothly, "that Galad's duties keep him in the north. You should be proud. He is one of the best young officers among the children."
Her stepson was a lever to use on her at need, one best used now by keeping him away. The young man was a good officer, perhaps the best to join the children in Nile's time.
and there was no need to put strains on his oath by letting him know his mother was here, and a guest only by courtesy. No more than a slight tightening of her mouth, quickly gone, betrayed her disappointment. This was not the first time she had made that request, nor would it be the last. Morgay Strachand did not surrender just because it was plain she was beaten.
"As you say, my Lord Nile,"
she said so meekly that he nearly choked on his wine. Submissiveness was a new tactic, one she must have worked up with difficulty.
"It is just a mother's..."
"My Lord Captain Commander,"
a deep, resonant voice broke in from the doorway.
"I fear I have important news that cannot wait, my lord."
Abdul Omerna stood tall in the white and gold tabard of a Lord Captain of the Children of the Light, bold face framed by wings of white at his temples, dark eyes deep and thoughtful. From head to toe he was fearless and commanding, and a fool, though that was not apparent at a glance. Morgay's drew in on herself at the sight of Omerna, so small a motion most men would not have noticed. She believed him spymaster for the children, as everyone did, a man to be feared almost as much as Asunawa, perhaps more. Even Omerna himself did not know he was but a decoy to keep eyes away from the true master of spies, a man known only to Nile himself. Seban Balwer, Nile's dry little stick of a secretary. Yet, decoy or not, something useful did pass through Omerna's hands on occasion. On rare occasions, something dire. Nile had no doubts what the man had brought. Nothing else except Randall Thor at the gates would have sent him barging in this way. The light's end, it was all a rug merchant's madness.
"I fear our gaming is done for this morning," Nile told Morgays, standing.
He offered her a slight bow as she rose, and she acknowledged it by inclining her head.
"Until this evening, perhaps?"
Her voice still held that almost docile tone.
"That is, if you will dine with me."
Nile accepted, of course. He did not know where she was leading with this new tactic, not where an oaf might suppose he was sure, but it would be amusing to find out. The woman was full of surprises. Such a pity she was trained by the witches. Omerna advanced as far as the great sunflare of gold set in the floor that had been worn by feet and knees over centuries. It was a plain room aside from that, and the captured banners that lined the walls high beneath the ceiling, age tattered and worn. Omerna watched her skirt around him without really acknowledging his presence, and when the door closed behind her, he said,
"I have not yet found Elaine or Gawain, my lord."
"Is that your important news?" Nile demanded irritably.
Balwar reported Morgaze's daughter and Ebu Dar, still mired to her neck with the witches. Orders concerning her had already been sent to Jaqim Caradhin. Her other son still toiled with the witches as well, it seemed, in Tarvalin, where even Balwar possessed few eyes and ears. Nile took a long swallow of cool wine. His bones felt old and brittle and cold of late. Yet the shadow-spawned heat made his skin sweat enough and dried his mouth. Omerna gave a start.
No, my lord.
He fumbled in a pocket of his white undercoat and pulled out a tiny bone cylinder with three red stripes running its length.
You wanted this brought as soon as the pigeon arrived in the...
He cut off as Nile snatched the tube. This was what he had been waiting for. The reason a legion was not already on its way to Andor, with Morgays riding at its head, if not leading. If it was not all Varadin's madness, the ravings of a man unbalanced by watching Taraban collapse into anarchy, Andor would have to wait. Andor and maybe more.
I have confirmation that the White Tower truly has broken, Omerna went on. The Black Aja has seized Tarvalin.
No wonder he sounded nervous, speaking heresy. There was no Black Aja. All of the witches were dark friends. Nile ignored him and broke the wax sealing the tube with his thumbnail. He had used Balwar to start those rumors, and now they came back to him.
Omerna believed every rumor his ears caught, and his ears caught them all.
"And there are reports that the witches are conferring with the false dragon Althor, my lord."
Of course the witches were conferring with him. He was their creation, their puppet. Niall shut out the fool's blather and moved back to the gaming table while he drew a slim roll of paper from the tube. He never let anyone know more of these messages than that they existed, and few knew that much. His hands trembled as they unrolled the thin paper. His hands had not trembled since he was a boy facing his first battle, more than 70 years ago. Those hands seemed little more than bone and sinew now, but they still possessed enough strength for what he had to do. The writing was not that of Varadin, but of Phazar, sent to Taraban for a different purpose. Niall's stomach twisted into a knot as he read. It was in clear language, not Varadin's cipher. Varadin's reports had been the work of a man on the brink of madness, if not over. Yet Phazar confirmed the worst of it, and more, much more. Althor was a rabid beast, a destroyer who must be stopped. But now a second mad animal had appeared, one that might be even more dangerous than the Tarvalan witches with their tame false dragon. But how under the light could he fight both?
It seems that Queen Tenobia has left Saldaea, my lord, and the Dragonsworn are burning and killing across Altara and Murindi. I have heard the Horn of Valir has been found, in Kandor.
Still half-distracted, Niall looked up to find Omerna at his side, licking his lips and wiping sweat from his forehead with the back of his hand. No doubt he hoped for a glance at what was in the message. Well, everyone would know soon enough.
"It seems one of your wilder fancies wasn't so wild after all," Niall said.
And that was when he felt the knife go in under his ribs. Shock froze him long enough for Omerna to pull the dagger free and plunge it in again. Other Lord Captain Commanders had died this way before him, yet he had never thought it would be Omerna. He tried to grapple with his killer, but there was no force in his arms. He hung on to Omerna with the man supporting him, the pair of them eye to eye. Omerna's face was red. He looked ready to weep.
"It had to be done. It had to be. You let the witches sit there in Solidar, unhindered, and—"
As if suddenly realizing that he had his arms around the man he was murdering, he pushed Niall away. Strength had gone from Niall's legs now as well as his arms. He fell heavily against the gaming table, turning it over. Black and white stones scattered across the polished wooden floor around him. The silver pitcher bounced and splashed wine. The cold in his bones was leaching out into the rest of him. He was not certain whether time had slowed for him, or everything really did happen so quickly. Boots thudded across the floor, and he lifted his head wearily to see Omerna gaping and wide-eyed, backing away from Eamon Valda. Every bit as much the picture of a Lord Captain as Omerna in his white and gold tabard and white undercoat, Valda was not so tall, not so plainly commanding, but the dark man's face was hard, as ever, and he had a sword in his hands, the Heronmark blade he prized so highly.
"Treason!"
Valda bellowed, and drove the sword through Omerna's chest. Niall would have laughed if he could. Breath came hard, and he could hear it bubbling in the blood in his throat. He had never liked Valda. In fact, he despised the man, but someone had to know. His eyes shifted from the slip of paper from Tanchico, lying not far from his hand. It might be missed there, but not if his corpse clutched it. And that message had to be read. His hand seemed to crawl across the floorboards so slowly, brushing the paper, pushing at it as he fumbled to take hold. His vision was growing misty. He tried to force himself to see. He had to. The fog was thicker. Part of him tried to shake that thought. There was no fog. The fog was thicker, and there was an enemy out there, unseen, hidden, as dangerous as Althor or more. The message. What? What message? It was time to mount and outsword. Time for one last attack. By the light, win or die, he was coming. he tried to snarl.
Valda wiped his blade on Amerna's tabard, then suddenly realized the old wolf still breathed, a rasping, bubbling sound. Grimacing, he bent to make an end, and a gaunt, long-fingered hand caught his arm.
"Would you be Lord Captain Commander now, my son?"
Asunawa's emaciated face belonged on a martyr, yet his dark eyes burned with a fervor to unnerve even those who did not know who he was.
"You may well be, after I attest that you killed Patron Niles' assassin, but not if I must say that you ripped open Niles' throat as well."
Baring teeth in what could pass for a smile, Valda straightened. Asunawa had a love of truth, a strange love. He could tie it into knots, or hang it up and flay it while it screamed, but so far as Valda knew, he never actually lied. A look at Niles' glazed eyes and the pool of blood spreading beneath him satisfied Valda. The old man was dying.
"May, Asunawa?"
The High Inquisitor's gaze burned hotter as Asunawa stepped back, moving the snowy cloak away from Niles' blood. Even a Lord Captain was not supposed to be that familiar.
"I said may, my son. You have been oddly reluctant to agree that the witch Morgaze must be given to the Hand of the Light. Unless you give that assurance..."
"Morgaze is needed yet."
Breaking in gave Valda considerable pleasure. He did not like questioners, the Hand of the Light as they called themselves. Who could like men who never met an enemy not disarmed and in chains? They held themselves apart from the children, separate. Asunawa's cloak bore only the scarlet shepherd's crook of the questioners, not the flaring golden sun of the children that graced his own tabard. Worse, they seemed to think their work with racks and hot irons was the only true work of the children.
"Morgaze gives us Andor, so you cannot have her before we have it. And we cannot take Andor until the Prophet's mobs are crushed."
The Prophet had to be first, preaching the coming of the Dragon Reborn, his mobs burning villages too slow to proclaim for Althor. Niles' chest barely moved now.
"Unless you want to trade Amadisia for Andor instead of holding both. I mean to see Althor hung and the White Tower ground to dust, Asunawa. And I did not go along with your plan just to see you toss it all on the midden."
Asunawa was not taken aback. He was no coward. Not here, with hundreds of questioners in the fortress and most of the children wary of putting a foot wrong around them. He ignored the sword in Valda's hands, and that martyr's face took on a look of sadness. His sweat seemed to be tears of regret.
"In that case, since Lord Captain Convila believes that the law must be obeyed, I fear
Convila agrees with me, Asunawa."
Since dawn, he did, since he realized that Valda had brought half a legion into the fortress. Convila was no fool.
"The question is not whether I will be Lord Captain Commander when the sun sets today, but who will guide the Hand of the Light in its digging for truth."
No coward, Asunawa, and even less a fool than Convila. He neither flinched nor demanded how Valda thought to bring this about.
"I see,"
he said after a moment, and then mildly,
"Do you mean to flout the law entirely, my son?"
Valda almost laughed.
"You can examine Morgaze, but she is not to be put to the question. You can have her for that when I am done with her."
Which might take a little time. Finding a replacement for the Lion Throne, one who understood her proper relationship to the children, as King Aelron did here, would not happen overnight. Perhaps Asunawa understood, and perhaps not. He opened his mouth, and there was a gasp from the doorway. Niles' pinch-faced secretary stood there, purse-mouthed and knobby, narrow eyes trying to stare at everything except the bodies stretched out on the floor.
"A sad day, Master Balwer,"
Asunawa intoned, his voice sorrowful iron.
"The traitor Omerna has slain our Lord Captain Commander Pedron Nile, the light illumine his soul.
Not an advance on the truth. Niall's chest no longer moved, and killing him had been treason.
Lord Captain Valda entered too late to save him, but he did slay Omerna in the full depth of his sin.
Bulwer gave a start and began dry-washing his hands. The bird-like fellow made Valda itch.
"Since you are here, Bulwer, you may as well be useful."
He disliked useless people, and the Scribbler was the very form of uselessness.
"Carry this message to each Lord Captain in the fortress. Tell them the Lord Captain Commander has been murdered, and I call for a meeting of the Council of the Anointed."
His first act on being named Lord Captain Commander would be to boot the dried-up little man out of the fortress, boot him so far he bounced twice, and choose a secretary who did not twitch.
"Whether Omerna was bought by the witches or the prophet, I mean to see Pedra Nile avenged."
"As you say, my lord."
Bulwer's voice was dry and narrow.
"It shall be as you say."
He apparently found himself able to look on Nile's body at last. As he bowed himself out jerkily, he hardly looked at anything else.
"So it seems you will be our next Lord Captain Commander after all,"
Asinawa said once Bulwer was gone.
"So it seems," Valda answered dryly.
A tiny slip of paper lay next to Niall's outstretched hand, the sort used in sending messages by pigeon. Valda bent and picked it up, then exhaled in disgust. The paper had been sitting in a puddle of wine. Whatever had been written on it was lost, the ink a blur.
"And the hand will have more gaze when your need for her is done."
That was not in the slightest a question.
"I will hand her to you myself."
Perhaps a little something might be arranged to sate Asinawa's appetite for a while. It might make sure Morgay's remained amenable, too. Valda dropped a bit of rubbish on Niall's corpse. The old wolf had lost his cunning and his nerve with age, and now it would be up to Eamon Valda to bring the witches and their false dragon to heel. Flat on his belly on a rise, Gawain surveyed disaster beneath the afternoon sun. Demise Wells lay miles to the south now, across rolling plain and low hills, but he could still see the smoke from burning wagons. What had happened there, after he led what he could gather of the younglings in breaking out, he did not know. Althor had seemed well in charge, Althor and those black-coated men who appeared to be channeling, taking down Aes Sedai and Aiel alike. It had been the realization that sisters were fleeing that told him it was time to go. He wished he could have killed Althor. For his mother, dead by the man's doing. Egwene denied it, but she had no proof. For his sister. If Min had spoken the truth, he should have made her leave the camp with him, whatever she wanted. There was too much he should have done differently today. If Min was right, and Elaine loved Althor, then that dreadful fate was reason enough to kill. Maybe the Aiel had done the work for him. He doubted it, though. With a sour laugh, he raised the tube of his looking glass. One of the golden bands bore an inscription, "From Morgays, Queen of Andor, to her beloved son Gawain. May he be a living sword for his sister and Andor." Bitter words now. There was not much to see beyond sere grass and small scattered clumps of trees. The wind still gusted, raising waves of dust. Occasionally a flash of movement in a crease between squat ridges spoke of men on the move. Aiel, he was sure. They blended with the land too well to be green-coated younglings. The light send that more had escaped than those he had brought out.
He was a fool. He should have killed Althor. He had to kill him.
But he could not. Not because the man was the dragon reborn, but because he had promised Egwene not to raise a hand against Althor. As a lowly accepted, she had vanished from Cairhien, leaving Gawain only a letter that he had read and reread until the paper was ready to tear along the folds. And he would not be surprised to learn she had gone to aid Althor in some way. He could not break his word, least of all to the woman he loved. Never his word to her, whatever the cost to himself. He hoped she would accept the compromise he had made with his honor. He had raised not a hand to harm, but none to help, either. The light said she never asked that of him. It was said that love addled men's brains, and he was the proof. Suddenly he pressed the looking-glass to his eye as a woman galloped a tall black horse into the open. He could not make out her face, but no servant would be wearing a dress divided for riding. So at least one Aes Sedai had managed to escape. If sisters had made it out of the trap alive, maybe more of the younglings had, too. With luck, he could find them before they were killed in small groups by the Aiel. First, there was the matter of this sister, though. In many ways, he would rather have gone on without her, but leaving her alone, maybe to take an arrow she never saw coming, was not an option he could allow himself. As he started to rise and wave to her, though, the horse stumbled and fell, pitching her over its head. He cursed, then again, when the looking-glass showed him an arrow standing up from the black's side. Hastily he scanned the hills and bit down on another curse. Maybe 24 veiled Aiel stood on a crest staring toward downed horse and rider, less than 100 paces from the Aes Sedai. Quickly he glanced back. The sister rose unsteadily to her feet. If she kept her wits and used the power, there should be no way a few Aiel could harm her, especially if she took shelter against more arrows behind the fallen horse. Even so, he would feel better when he had gathered her in. Rolling away from the crest to lessen the chances of the Aiel seeing him, he slid down the reverse slope until he could stand. He had brought 581 younglings south, almost everyone who was far enough along in training to leave Tarvalen, but fewer than 200 waited on their horses in the hollow. Before disaster struck at Dumai's Wells, he was certain there had been a plot afoot to see that he and the younglings died without returning to the White Tower. Why, he did not know, nor whether the scheme came from Elida or Galena, but it had succeeded well enough, if not exactly in the way its devisers had thought. Small wonder that he would have preferred to go on without Aes Sedai, had he any choice. He stopped beside a tall gray gelding with a young rider. Young, as indeed all the younglings were. Many did not need to shave beyond every third day, and a few still only pretended even that. But Jasau wore the silver tower on his collar, marking him a veteran of the fighting when Swan Sanche was deposed, and scars beneath his clothes from fighting since. He was one of those who could skip the razor most mornings. His dark eyes belonged to a man 30 years older, though. What did his own eyes look like, Gawain wondered.
Jasau, we have a sister to pull out of the...
The 100 or so Aiel who came trotting over the low rise to the west recoiled in surprise at finding the younglings below, but neither surprise nor the younglings' superior numbers held them back. In a flash they veiled and plunged down the slope, darting in with spears, stabbing at horses as often as riders, working in pairs. Yet if the Aiel knew how to fight men on horseback, the younglings had recently had rough lessons in how to fight Aiel, and slow learners did not live long in their ranks. Some carried slender lances, ending in a foot and a half of steel with a crossguard to prevent the head penetrating too deeply, and all could use their swords as well as any but a blade master. They fought in twos and threes, each man watching another's back, keeping their mounts moving so the Aiel could not hamstring the animals. Only the quickest Aiel managed to get inside those circles of flashing steel. The war-trained horses themselves were weapons, splitting skulls with their hooves, seizing men with their teeth, and shaking them like dogs worrying rats, jaws tearing away half a man's face. The horses screamed as they fought, and men grunted with effort, shouted with the fever that overtook men in battle, the fever that said they were alive and would live to see another sunrise if they had to wade waist-deep in blood. They shouted as they killed, shouted as they died. There seemed little difference. Gawain had no time to watch or listen, though. The only youngling afoot, he attracted attention. Three cotton-sore-clad figures dodged through the horsemen, rushing at him with spears ready. Perhaps they thought him easy meat, 3-on-1. He disabused them. His sword left the scabbard smoothly as he flowed from the falcon stoops, to the creeper embraces the oak, to the moon rises over the lakes. 3 times he felt the shock in his wrists of blade meeting flesh, and that quickly 3 veiled Aielmen were down, 2 still moving weakly, but they were out of the fight as much as the other. The next to confront him was a different matter. A lean fellow, overtopping Gawain by a hand, he moved like a snake, spear flickering while his buckler darted and slanted to deflect sword strokes with a force Gawain could feel to his shoulders. The wood-grouse dances, became folding the air, became the courier taps his fan, and the Aielman met each of them at the cost of a slash along his ribs, while Gawain took a gash on his thigh that only a quick twist kept from being a stab clean through. They circled one another, oblivious to whatever happened around them. Blood oozed hot down Gawain's leg. The Aielman fainted, hoping to draw him off balance, fainted again. Gawain shifted from stance to stance, sword now high, now low, hoping the man would extend one of those half-thrusts just a little too far. In the end, it was chance that decided matters. The Aielman abruptly stumbled a step, and Gawain ran him through the heart before he even saw the horse that had backed into the man. Once he would have felt regret. He had grown up believing that if 2 men must fight, the duel should proceed honorably and cleanly. More than half a year of battles and skirmishes had taught him better. He put a foot on the Aielman's chest and wrenched his blade free. Ungallant but fast, and in battle, slow was often dead. Only, when his sword was free, there was no need for speed. Men were down, younglings and Aielmen, some groaning, some still, and the rest of the Aiel streaming away to the east, harried by 2 dozen younglings, including some who should know better.
"Hold!"
he shouted. If the idiots allowed themselves to become separated, the Aiel would cut them to dog meat.
"No pursuit! Hold, I said! Hold, burn you!"
The younglings pulled up reluctantly. Jasau reined his gelding around. "They just thought to cut a path through us on the way wherever they're going, my lord." His sword dripped red from half its length. Gawain caught the reins of his own bay stallion and swung into the saddle, not waiting to clean or sheathe his blade. No time to see who was dead, who might live.
"Forget them! That sister is waiting for us. I'll keep your half-troop to look after the wounded. And watch those Aiel. Just because they are dying doesn't mean they have quit. The rest, follow me."
Hal saluted with his sword, but Gawain was already digging in his spurs. The skirmish had not lasted long, yet too long, however short. When Gawain reached the crest, only the dead horse was to be seen, its saddlebags turned out. Scanning through his looking-glass revealed not a sign of the sister, the Aiel, or anything else living. All that moved was wind-blown dust and a dress on the ground near the horse, stirring in the gusts. The woman must have sprinted to be so completely out of sight so quickly.
"She can't have gone far, even running," Jasau said. "We can find her if we fan out."
"We'll search after we see to the wounded,"
Gawain replied firmly. He was not about to split up his men with Aiel roaming loose. Only a few hours yet till sunset, and he wanted a tight camp on high ground before then. It might be as well if he did manage to find a sister or two. Someone was going to have to explain this catastrophe to Elida, and he would assume it was an Aes Sedai facing her wrath, not him. Turning his bay with a sigh, he rode back down to see what the butcher's bill had been this time. That had been his first real lesson as a soldier. You always had to pay the butcher. He had a feeling there would be bigger bills due soon. The world would forget Dumai's Wells in what was coming.